is on organic matter characterization, development, and management in turfgrass systems. Rock is going to be presenting with his co-authors that you see listed there. There are many things I could say about this talk that I'm not going to, so because I'm very nice when it comes to these things in Rock. But I'll let Rock take over here.
Brian, I'm not quite sure how to take that, but I think I know why. I'm the last to get my chapters in for Brian. He's kind of got an issue with that. I don't know why. It's just a slight issue. He quit sending me emails. That's how mad he is.
You quit responding to my emails.
Well, so?
I know the guilt factor's taking over.
Okay, we're going to actually have a talk now, but I'm not going to talk to you anymore. I do have to thank my authors. This was an endeavor that turned out to be far more complex than we ever thought it would be. And, you know, there's a lot of us that do organic matter work. I'm going to say that the majority of us do it wrong. We're not really looking at the procedures and stuff that we should be the way we should be. And hopefully this chapter will bring us all kind of to a central ground. And whether you agree or disagree with you're doing it right or wrong, I think you're going to find some things that we found really intriguing. But we had some great authors besides myself, or in spite of me. William Berendt or Lee Berendt, he's at Florida Gulf Coast University. He was a graduate student at Michigan State when I was there. He's done a lot of thatch work without a research appointment, and he did a lot of the characterization chapter work. Colm Dockrell was a former student of mine who's a senior lecturer at the National Arboretum in Dublin, Ireland, and runs a bunch of students through his program. Really, really accomplished rock. And also gave us that European perspective, or at least from the very least, the Irish perspective on organic matter. And you'll hear some comments in that regard as well. And then Ray Driver, she's a soil microbial ecologist in our department. And we would write chapters or sections where we'd mention something about microbial interactions, and she would come back with a slew of constructive criticisms about how we sort of probably are misinterpreting, and then would clarify them and give us some references to go. The goal of this chapter, actually, when it was all said and done, was that we wanted to have a comprehensive look at everything that we hadn't looked at in organic matter work, you know, since the last monograph. But the reality of it was that we had to go back much further than that. Here are the chapter topics. We're not going to go all through all of them one by one, but you know, this thing was supposed to be comprehensive. I thought the idea of a monograph was we should have a comprehensive lit review. We have over 250 references. That's after we pruned that back from almost 400 in the original first drafts. We didn't do what we tend to do in turf a lot. We tried not to be as provincial, and we went way outside the turf literature and into some characterization work that was done in soils and some environmental fate work. So hopefully that'll be useful to especially the younger scientists in the room if they decide to pursue this a little bit. But we're going to actually concentrate on two things: definitions, which seems kind of rudimentary, but you're going to see an interesting trend in the definitions in both turfgrass science as well as SSSS at the Soil Science Society of America. And then we're going to look at sampling and analytical methods to characterize organic matter. In my opinion, that's where we see the greatest problem or disconnect in all the work that's out there. Really good work, but people aren't really following any kind of standardization. There's probably reasons for that. So if we go to what's supposed to be our source, the Soil Science Society of America's glossary of terms on the web, we get a definition for soil organic matter. Now, you look in the popular press for turf, golf course management, golfdom, whatever, various trade journals, you'll see them refer to SOM as surface organic matter. That's one of the first mistakes we tend to make in our discipline, is that it's not surface organic matter in technical terms, it's soil organic matter, which is simply the organic fraction of the soil exclusive of undecayed plant and animal residues. That'll be key to understanding how this has sort of progressed after that. So then, after that, they come up with this idea of particulate organic matter, and the definition that they often refer to that in the literature is POM, the microbial active fraction. So this would be where the microbes are hanging out and having a good time and reproducing and doing all the things that they like to do, having parties, drinking beer, the whole bit. That's where they would do that in the POM region. Soil organic matter consisting of fine particles of partially decomposed plant tissue, microbial biomass, including fungal hyphae, fungal faunal residues, and other biologically oriented materials such as seed and spores. This came long after the original definition of soil organic matter, and then we come up with this particulate because they realized that all the work that had done prior to this sort of this discovery of how to analyze for and isolate particulate organic matter, they kept on saying that it was that organic matter, it had to be dead. It couldn't be alive. Well, the way we sample, even if you're the best of samplers, is you take a sample, and obviously in an annual crop, it's probably in the after harvest. You know, that's going to probably be, most of that root mass in there is going to be dead or on its way out. But in perennial systems, it's not. It's actually got active root growth, et cetera. And so there, you get this disconnect between whether it's living or dead, and it's especially true in the turf literature. But they realized that they were also actually not meeting their own defined term. And then you will go to the humic substances, and then this is where we really get into some, there's a lot of products out there that are humic acid-based or humans or whatever you want to call them, because this is a really nondescript group. There's a lot of them out there, and they're not as well described. And so if a product has humic acid in it, we make comment on this in the chapter, and you don't know what humic acid constituent it is or complex, it may or may not have any advantage in that as an application in a turf grass system or in an agronomic system for that matter as well. So, but that's sort of we go from the very fairly recognizable plant tissue to something less recognizable, and now it's being colonized by saprophytic organisms, et cetera. And then finally we go to this much more degraded, well on its way to being essentially compost in the humic substances. Here's the definitions in the turf literature. We can go back quite a ways to the first references of organic matter in turfgrass soils, about the 1920s. And then they would describe it as a mat, and you're going to see this term come up quite a bit, a mat of excess stolons, mat formation of creeping backgrass and bermudagrass was becoming a serious problem. We start seeing that mentioned in the early 1940s. So this isn't a new problem when we talk about the organic matter surface as a soil organic matter, but we in turf we started to refer to it as mat long before we ever introduced the term thatch. It wasn't until the 1950s you can find your first reference to thatch in the literature. And basically, the definition was accumulation of stems and leaves built up on the surface of the greens. Notice they're always referring to greens. So all the research up to this point in time is being done on green-type conditions. The term was used at this point in time in the early 1940s into the late 40s interchangeably with mat. So whether it was a trade journal article or a scientific article, they'd say mat and be referring to thatch and vice versa. They really didn't separate those out. Wasn't until about 1960 we got definitions like mat, an undecomposed mass of living roots and stems hidden below green vegetation, and a thatch. Thatch was an accumulation of dead but undecomposed stems and leaves of the soil surface. We're still not to where most of the students today are learning the term. Finally, Beard's classic definition in 1973, thatch, a tightly intermingled layer of dead and living stems and roots that develops between the zone of green vegetation and the soil surface. And then Don Waddington came out in 1992 and said, well, tightly sort of over-defines it. It's probably more loosely defined. So depending upon whether you use Dr. Beard's or Dr. Waddington's definition, it's either a tight mass or a loose mass, but that's really not relevant. So we finally come up with this term, that thatch, right? And then finally, in 2008, I think you'll recognize this as Dr. Turgeon's definition because it's a paragraph long. But anyway, it's a layer of undecomposed or partially decomposed organic residues are situated above the soil surface and constituting the upper stratum of the medium that supports turf grass growth. If thatch is intermixed from soil, top dressing, or other sources, it is termed mat. Now, other people were using the term mat as exactly that, and actually, we'll show you some pictures from one of the early slide monographs that Keith has been involved in pretty much most of his career, Keith Carnock. But bottom line was, is it took us this long to get here. So you've got this parallel universe in the Soil Science Society where they come up with terminology and adjust it on the fly and come up with terms that meet their definitions. And in turf, we were doing the same thing. We sort of have a disconnect between the terminology, though, however used in soil science, which is probably the ones we should be following, and the ones we've sort of adopted in turf. And I'll say that across the board for anyone that's done any SOM work. Then finally, because of the inherent ambiguities and terminology and sampling techniques in the early 2000s, probably Bert McCarty was the first one to do it, and because it's hard to define these regions, he started calling it thatch mat, which sort of It was an easy way to get out of having to define the layer of thatch and the layer of mat as distinctly separate or not. And those of you that have done a lot of organic matter sampling, I think you can understand, like, you'll sit there and debate longer than it's probably worth, where do you make the cut to separate thatch from mat, and can you even reasonably do that? This is the classical CSSA slide set. This is right out of the set. And you get a sample like this. Yeah, good, you know, good for you, because this is going to be really easy to separate out the thatch from the soil and the grass. It's, you know, pretty straightforward. Okay, those of you that have done organic matter work, how often do your samples look like this?
Never.
They never look like this. Then you get into this, and we have what is defined as the mat layer, where soil is intermixed with the decomposing materials and mixed off with some live material. A little more ambiguous, you know, obviously separation here is going to be a little bit problem. Let's take one last look. And most of you are doing work in modified root zones, I would say, in based on the literature that we reviewed. And if you get a really clean sample like this in some of the work you're doing on greens, that's going to be an easy one. There's a very identifiable mat layer or top dressing layer. That darker color that shows the presence of some of the humic substances, et cetera. So you got a real clean break there between the soil below and the mat layer above. So that one would be relatively easy to make separations on. Let's look at just a boatload of cores and say, where are you going to draw the line on separating mat from soil? These are all from the same trial. So that's the kind of variability you deal with when you're trying to work with organic matter. And it's very similar to a lot of the constraints of trying to work with rooting. The analytical techniques one is kind of interesting to me, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But first of all, you know, if we're going to be a scientific discipline, we should use the scientific terms. Percent organic matter, while common, is actually an inaccurate way to express it. It's not even an acceptable SI unit. The acceptable SI unit for concentration is grams per kilogram. Why we don't use that kind of surprises me, because it's a real simple math exercise. To convert percent to get grams per kilogram is that you just take it and multiply it by 10. Now, I can understand in a conversation with a golf course superintendent, we may want to say, well, they understand the numbers a little bit better as being percentages. But if you're submitting anything for publication and you submit a percentage number, you're missing the boat on how you express that, because percent is so ambiguous. How was that sampled? It introduces a lot of error in your interpretation. And it's such a simple change. So in the chapter, we went back into all the papers that we looked at, and unfortunately a lot of them are in non-refereed sources, and they use the term percentage, and we converted them for that. But you'll see even in my presentation there, on occasion I slip. If I pulled a slide from an extension presentation, you'll see that we still use percent, because that seems to be the norm. It's the difference between using English and metric, essentially. But percent still is a unitless measure that introduces some questions of accuracy in the process. So we're going to talk about it as grams per kilogram. Analytical methods, though, there's not many of them out there, and there's some new technologies that we should probably be utilizing or not. But the most common methods for measuring soil organic matter are primarily used outside of turfgrass science is the amount of carbon in the soil. Now, you can convert that carbon, this SOM, by a conversion factor of 1.72. That's what the literature says. However, that conversion factor is not the same for all soils and is more precise to report soil carbon rather than soil organic matter. So we can use the carbon analysis, but we don't have the right correction factor for a turf system. So here's an opportunity for a scientist that wants to pursue this. Come up with that conversion factor for a couple of turf systems. It should be a slam dunk from a publication standpoint, because it's just not out there. We don't have the conversion factors. I think I skipped one. The potential to further investigate soil carbon analysis, as I already said, including carbon to organic matter conversion factors to refine organic matter concentration studies in the turfgrass system, is a viable research endeavor. It's one that somebody should take the lead on and just go with it, because that would help us clarify some of the things that we're doing in the organic matter arena. Okay, let's go back to what we tend to use in turf. Historically, in the turf literature, two methods have been used. One of them is more historical than the other. The loss on ignition technique is probably the most common method used. I think some of you are familiar with that. You basically take a sample, you dry it down in a pre-dry oven, then you take some weights, obviously, in process. Then you throw it in a combustion furnace, and it combusts all the organic matter off, and what's left behind is the organic matter. What's left behind is the mineral matter, and by simple calculations, you can determine grams per kilogram. It's not all that difficult. The Walkley-Black procedure has been used less in recent time, number one, because it involves some wet chemistry that's subject to error, and also when you use the Walkley-Black's method, you produce some hazardous waste, and it's got to be disposed of, et cetera. But there's still some fairly important seminal papers that use the Walkley-Black procedure. And that one got stuck in there. I already did that one. Sorry about that. There's a really good thesis out there. Unfortunately, it's only a thesis and hasn't been published yet. But Van Loo in 2008 at Michigan State University compared a carbon analysis method, the Walkley-Black, and the loss on ignition technique. The loss on ignition consistently indicated higher organic matter than the WB or C, and the Walkley-Black and the C were comparable. When you think about how, though, it's not surprising that that's what came out, because with the carbon method, there is some discriminatory separation of living and dead tissue. It's not real precise, but it does tend to work that way, and the WB has some potential for it. So it would underestimate that based on an LOI technique, because the LOI doesn't distinguish between living and dead tissue. So live roots, et cetera, come into play. Resulted in different values for the same sample. So if you're going to be looking at a paper that used the WB, or looking at some of the more current papers outside of the turfgrass literature are using a carbon analysis type system, you're going to get numbers that are all over the board. So when you want to cross compare these references or use them in a paper, make sure you're careful that you look at the units may be the same, but the methodology throws in another variability that you can't really compare WB to C or to LOI. So stick with the method, and when you're making your comparisons to other literature, make sure they use the same research procedures. This is where we get into just a hornet's nest of problems, though, is our sampling techniques. I took randomly. I didn't bias this because I have a bias, which is typically what I do. But I took 20 random samples of all the literature that we described, including some in the agricultural sector, et cetera. And we got depth from 5 to 30 centimeters and diameters of 2 to 10.9 centimeters, obviously a 10.9 being a cup cutter plug. Okay, the diameters aren't that critical, but the depth ones are. The most frequent sampling diameter and depth was 2.5 and 15 centimeters, respectively. And what is 15 centimeters in English units? How many inches? And what do we determine 6 inches is usually a plow pan layer. What was the last time we ran a plow over? Well, the early grading may be a plow. But when you look at it, we are using old agricultural terminology to determine our sampling depths. I've done it, and I could show you a lot of papers that did it as well, because that sort of was standard operating procedure. But the vertical organic matter stratifications, when you're looking at systems, especially in sand-based root zones, that happens, and especially if you're looking at comparisons across years or whatever, you run into a serious problem. Here are 4 identical samples. Actually, it's the same core taken, and all the way to your right. Okay, that one is a sample that we're using basically 4 different techniques that are out there that were in the literature, or they were reported by the labs. In one of them, they include the thatch mat layer, and then they go to the distinguishable layer, if present, between the mat layer and the underlying soil. So that's obviously the top dressing layer. Another lab recommends 1/2 inch off the top and go 4.5 inches deep. Another one says another method said they collected between 0 and 35 centimeters, basically leaving the thatch and growing green tissue after mowing on the surface. And then finally, one that was between 0 and 25 centimeters. When you go to read the literature, you're going to find that sampling thing is so variable from paper to paper. Any kind of cross comparisons, what do we always do in our papers? We say this agrees or confirms the data by X and Y or whatever. You can't really do that in organic matter just because of this inherent problem with sampling technique. And I think this is where we can probably make the greatest gains into sort of making that whole organic matter investigation a little bit clearer. But you could see how the sample that leaves a lot of the original root zone in there is going to grossly underestimate the organic matter content, or it will be lower, and versus the one all the way to your, I believe you're right, sorry, between 0 and 25 centimeters, that's going to really concentrate the sample, and it's going to be relatively high. You may say, well, as long as I'm only concerned about my trial, and that's true, but then try to relate that back to some of the other work, and you start introducing the sampling technique and all kinds of other things, and it just sort of makes it kind of muddy. We published a paper, Ty McClellan, one of our graduate students, he's now a USJ agronomist, and we had this aging green study, some of you are familiar with it, and nutrient and chemical properties of aging golf greens as impacted by soil depth and mat development. Samples were collected in 2004, basically at four depths, separated the thatch, 0 to 2.5 centimeters, 2.5 to 10 centimeters, and 10 to 20 centimeters. So you can kind of see how we took those samples from three cores per plot, and that's not really relevant. We just want to show you how the data came out. So we picked up a sampling depth interaction. We got no significant differences at the surface, no significant differences in the mat layer, and then we picked up a highly significant difference in that layer below the intense mat layer, and then down when we get into the original root zone, we get a non-significant layer. That was causing all kinds of confounding in our analysis of these green samples for a number of reasons. Now, could we have done some, more forward-thinking statistical analysis? Sure, we could have, but in multifactorials, it creates kind of a problem. A lot of the organic matter work is done that way. So this is what the data looks like, basically. You've got this obvious interaction from the depth of sampling. So if we turn around and resample that and simply take our mat sample at the same depth, right, and then separate out, get rid of the top part and get rid of the end part, but normalize that to based on the mat layer and the mat layer alone, all of a sudden the data becomes fairly clear, and you don't get that confounding effect of sampling depth. Now, this is a pretty simplistic approach. This is really the intention of this paper was not to look at that depth thing, but it still indicates that sampling depth is real critical, and we need to come up with some way to get this taken care of. And we sort of suggest a couple of examples in the book chapter, so you're going to have to do that. We also got to remember that when we're doing root zone work, especially with amended root zones, but even with other root zones, is that we top dress aggressively in many of these systems. It's part of the cultural practices or possibly part of one of the treatments. But you realize you're creating a new root zone with top dressing over a multiple. This is a green that was 8 years old in our study, and you can see you can still identify the original root zone. You can still physically see where it is because of the nature of why we top dressed. Rarely do we top dress with the same sand that we built the green out of, with just primarily because of another time on the sieve and the cost of the original root zone changes. But we then physically put on the top a top dressing sand that's probably not the same in particle size. It may meet some sort of specification, it isn't. And then we start talking about the green like it's a continuum, when in reality we created a root zone and then we created another root zone with aggressive top dressing over years. So unless you're top dressing with exactly the same material that you built the green out of, those data become confounded when you go into depth sampling because you're picking up sand of different particle size and different densities, probably, unless you're lucky enough to do them all. One of the last things I want to talk about is this magic number that out in the superintendent's head, that it's 3.5%. You know, our greens should never exceed 3.5% or they're going to fail. And you got to look back in the literature to understand where this number came from. And this I'm not picking on two other USJ agronomists, but Hartwinger and O'Brien published a paper in not a refereed paper, obviously, and said that you want to be between 3.5% and 4.5%. And that sort of became the magic number in those of us that are in extension positions and are advising golf course superintendents. And they said, I just did a sample on my green, and it was 5%. You know, what do I do? And they go into this sort of hyper anxiety mode that the green's going to fail because it doesn't fit in this magic zone. And then we look in the literature, and we have everything from some private labs saying that you want 1.5% to 2.5%. So there's some work out of New Zealand that says you can have, you know, you want it to be less than 8%. So why the variability? Some of that has to do with the sampling depths, et cetera, and, you know, and different methods of creating or getting the analytical technique that you use to get the organic matter. But really it's that I'm going to concentrate on that Hartwinger and O'Brien paper in the Green Section Record. That number came, they were citing two papers. One of them was a really nice piece of work that Bob Caro did in the Atlanta area on golf greens that were failing during the summer months in Atlanta. They were creeping bent grass greens in Atlanta. I'm not sure anything is going to change that, but Bob makes a case that it needs to be less than 3%, and he saw a strong correlation there. Nice piece of work. Bob didn't take it to publication, but he did put it in golf course management, and so that became kind of the new 3%. Well, that about, on or about the same time, Ed McCoy does a paper where he's constructing root zones for sports fields. And he's making, he says you don't want to ever, in the construction process, you don't ever want to exceed 3.5%. He was talking about constructed soils. Then he did soil physical measurements on these. He never actually grew grass on those root zones. If you read the paper in Agronomy Journal, you're going, okay, we're using this totally separate paper to advise superintendents on what their root zone soil organic matter in their root zone should be. And you look at that paper, and you realize that they never, ever grew grass on those. And 3.5%, when you're looking at, what would that be to volume to volume? What do you think that would approximately be? If in a 20% sphagnum peat moss green, they're usually 0.6 to 1% organic matter. So it would be about 40 to 50%. Organic matter. Number one, it's cost prohibitive. Number two, nobody would physically build a green like that. And Ed did a really nice job in bracketing those that were out there and figuring out. But that became the new magic number among superintendents, is that's what they wanted to target. And unfortunately, you'll still run into that as extension specialists where they say, well, I'm exceeding four, and I need to do something real aggressive to get rid of it. The reality is that number is not right. It's not even close to right. And I've been on golf courses that had organic matter contents of 7 or 8%, they're performing fine, but on golf courses that had 2%, and they weren't. And I think all of you that do this on a fair amount will see that. Bottom line, how do you get rid of organic matter? Because that was really where this chapter was supposed to go. We have a lot of information on characterization and everything. It's a great reference, but how do you get rid of organic matter? There's basically only three ways we'll talk about. We talked about those in depth, you know, trying to figure out exactly what the methodologies were out there. Basically, it boils down to three. Decomposition, which is a natural biological process. We have a little section on inoculants, not a whole lot of positive data on inoculating and trying to get rid of organic matter. Removal, generally core aerification is strongly recommended. Our data says otherwise. Power raking, you know, that's a fairly physically disturbing process. And then finally, dilution. We've done a fair amount of work in this, and I can summarize about 2.5 years worth of work, Chaz Smid work, in probably one slide. The solution to pollution is dilution. If you think organic matter is bad, you think you want to correct it, you can do it with sand without any cultivation technique, but you just got to make sure you get enough sand on there. And not to deny that you may cultivate for other reasons, but the bottom line is the success is in the sand. And it's really interesting because you go back in 1973 in Baird's classic book, To Fresh Science and Culture, and he goes, the best way to manage organic matter in any system is dilution with soil or sand. And we've played around with a lot of different techniques. I'm not sure we have made much advances. So there's the chapter topics. Once again, if you want to know more about the other chapters, you're going to have to cop out and pay the money and buy the book. Opportunity. This is where I want to end. There is a tremendous potential for extensive work in organic matter and turfgrass systems that has not yet been done. There's a lot of papers that don't really answer the question and create more, some of ours as well. Funding opportunities are probably going to be limited. I'm not sure this is something that even the USGA would consider specifically for funding. They have in the past. I'm not sure that they figured out anything from that data other than what we already knew. Collaboration will be the key, including working outside of the turfgrass academic community to get to the people that do the carbon analysis. Work with your soil scientists. Many of you already do. And look at the other schools that incorporated people outside the turfgrass discipline at their institutions to get successful grant opportunities. Maybe look at it at a carbon sequestration, which Yelling has done very, very well, something along those lines. But there are opportunities, and I think when you read the chapter, you'll find that we're a long way from really understanding the dynamics of a organic matter system. This is one of our last quotes, and basically says, we're more confused than ever, at least as author of this chapter, I'm more confused than ever because I thought we knew things, and once we did a real thorough lit review, we found out that we were probably nowhere near as close to understanding the dynamics if we really want to manage organic matter in a turfgrass system. Thank you.
We have time for a few questions.
Yeah, Jim.
Brock, I appreciate your summary there of kind of a golf-centric topic. Organic matter management, but in my region there is more and more interest in soil restoration in more urban, suburban soil environments, and so the big topic there is add organic matter to restore those soils, but the question is how much, what type of organic matter. So I'm curious, how much did you run across anything like that in your review, and to what extent do you address it?
Jim's question was basically restoration of disturbed urban soils and what are the organic matter recommendations, or did we run across any specific recommendations? And there's a lot of non-research-based information. You know, organic is good and you need to add compost. It's probably the common theme. In terms of specifics about proportions and other things, they run the gamut. That, you know, the National Composting Council has some numbers and they seem to be the most reasonable. But when we tried to look at anything, you know, scientifically based and actually researched, we really came up short, especially in the urban soil, the disturbed soil arena. So we really don't have anything definitive in there, but obviously we've got enough of the information in the chapter that would tell you there's some benefit. How much benefit is still subject to interpretation. Other questions? Those of you that aren't working with organic matter, are you going to work with it now? Those of you who are going to quit? John. Yes. The question was, does our chapter say what happens to organic matter concentration after core cultivation? And we have that based on some work of our students have done, primarily Chaz Schmidt, and the indication that core cultivation probably isn't critical for managing organic matter. We make a fairly strong case for that and show some data in that regard. We haven't published that paper yet, so we don't want to put too much data in the chapter, but it's there. Other questions? All right. Thanks, thank you, Rob. So much.